The headlines: Afghan officials say government forces have repelled an attack by Taliban militants on a major border crossing with Pakistan. An explosion targeting a bus in northern Pakistan kills at least 13 people, including 9 Chinese nationals. And a UN report says the number of migrants who lost their lives while trying to reach Europe by sea has dramatically increased this year. Top story for this half hour. The Taliban say they've captured an important trade route linking Pakistan with southern Afghanistan. A Taliban spokesman says the border town of Wesh and a road linking the two countries' customs in Kandahar province is now under the control of the militants. This is while the Afghan government says its forces have repelled the Taliban attack on the transit point. Taliban militants have already captured 3 other crossings along Afghanistan's borders. They've increased their attacks on cities and villages since May, seizing dozens of rural districts. Amin Alami says the fight between the Taliban and Afghan forces in the border region of Kandahar province has inflicted heavy losses on the militants.
Sources in Kandahar say that as a result of counterattack operation conducted by Afghan special forces, mainly Afghan border troops, over 50 Taliban militants have been killed, including foreign nationals. But in the meantime, the Taliban says that they are struggling to bring more areas under their own control. The locals and villagers there say that fightings are underway in some parts of Ispin Buldak in southern Kandahar province of Afghanistan, and in some cases civilians have lost their lives.
An explosion targeting a bus in northern Pakistan has left over a dozen people dead and many others injured.
This heart-wrenching incident took place at the Barsin area. It was a bus with 41 people on board. 6 of them died on the spot. The investigation is underway to find out what was the actual cause of the incident. Police and the bomb disposal squad are on the site.
A Pakistani official said the bus was carrying Chinese engineers, surveyors, and mechanical staff to the site of an under-construction dam in Upper Kuhistan. He said 9 Chinese nationals were among the dead and 28 others were injured. Security officials are investigating the cause of the blast. The Dasu Hydroelectric Dam project is part of the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor that is aimed at connecting western China to Gwadar Seaport in southern Pakistan. The United Arab Emirates has officially opened an embassy in Israel. The Emirati embassy is located in Tel Aviv. The move followed the inauguration of Israel's embassy and consulate in the UAE last month. The measures are the latest steps by the two sides to formalize ties after they reached a normalization agreement in August 2020. Several Arab countries, including the UAE, normalized their relations with Israel under U.S. brokered agreements last year when former U.S. President Donald Trump was in office. Palestinians call the normalization a stab in their back. The official inauguration of the United Arab Emirates Embassy in Israel has sparked widespread condemnation from different Palestinian factions. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad resistance movement called the normalization with Israel a betrayal, a crime, and an ignorance of the truth. The movement spokesman Tariq Salmi said the UAE's move would be recorded in history, for it came at the height of the crimes of the occupying regime against the people of Palestine. Palestinian Fatah movement also decried the opening of the UAE embassy in Israel and called for the expulsion of the Persian Gulf monarchy from the Arab League. Fatah official Abbas Zaki called Abu Dhabi's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed a traitor and warned against the expanding influence of the Zionists in the UAE. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent Mona Candy, who's joining us from Ramon Hall. So we have Mr. Mick Napier from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign joining us from Edinburgh. Welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mona in Ramallah. Mona, we've been getting a lot of reactions from the Palestinians as the United Arab Emirates has officially opened an embassy in Israel. Tell us more, please.
Well, yes, it's the first Arab-Persian Gulf state to be opening an embassy in the occupation regime's state in Tel Aviv. Specifically, what happened today is that a ceremony attended by new Israeli President Ishaq Herzog, as well as the United Arab Emirates Ambassador to Israel, Mohammed Al-Khaja. He called the opening of the embassy in Tel Aviv as an important milestone in growing relationship with Israel. At the same time, the Israeli president hoped that this opening of an Arab embassy in Tel Aviv would be leading to other states to follow the step of the United Arab of Emirates, saying it a historic agreement. However, of course, this move once again is angering the Palestinians. They slammed the move by the United Arab of Emirates, considering it another step in the back of the Palestinians, as well as a treason. They are believing, Palestinians today, that United Arab of Emirates are giving the Israeli regime a green light to carry on the massacres, as well as the aggression and violence be committed against the Palestinians, as well as giving up the Palestinian holy lands by opening an embassy in Tel Aviv. This means it's collaborating and being a strong ally with Israel, especially that relations had been completely halted between these countries, or at least public relations. Palestinians have many times warned that the relations that's been carrying out under the table would now be open ties and open relations. It's not only public relations between Arab states and Israel. It's completely considered normalization of ties, not only economic relations, but that would lead to completely relations and ties with the occupying regime. It was forbidden for Arab states for so long to deal with the Israelis or even speak about open ties with the Israeli regime, at least when it ends its occupation of the Palestinian territories and accepts to give the Palestinians their land to establish their owned and independent state.
Mona, staying with you for a quick question. The Palestinians believe that not just the United Arab Emirates, but all the other Arab governments that have normalized ties with the Israelis have effectively turned their back on the Palestinian cause and their Palestinian brothers.
It wasn't only United Arab of Emirates. UAE last year agreed under the American administration led by U.S. President Donald Trump, agreed to have these normalization of ties under what's known as the Abraham Agreement. Then there was Bahrain, there was Morocco, and there was Sudan. This had triggered, protest and demonstrations all across the occupied West Bank, as well as in the Gaza Strip. Palestinians were saying that those states, they sold the Palestinian question and the Palestinian issue to Israel. Regarding the normalization of ties, even if they were saying it's only an agreement. However, Palestinians never considered it only an agreement. They considered that those states were eager to speak about their ties that were maybe being carried out under the table, secret relations and secret contacts with the Israeli regime. However, they claimed at first that there was kind of a pressure from the American administration, and this issue was going to pressurize the Israeli regime not to annex Palestinian lands, the major parts of the occupied West Bank, and to stop the deal of the century. It was for the benefit of the Palestinians. However, all this was not correct. They were mistaken, because Palestinians had preferred if they would stand with the Palestinians in other means, especially that the Israeli regime. And Netanyahu, when he was the prime minister, he made it clear that he didn't make any promises to those Arab states that he will not annex any West Bank areas.
Mick Napier in Edinburgh, give us your thoughts on the opening of the UAE embassy in Israel, and also about the reactions. Palestinians believe that this move by the UAE would be recorded in history, for it, quote, came at the height of the crimes of the occupying regime against the people of Palestine. Break that down for us, please.
How can one disagree with that assessment? I'm reminded of the fact that when there was a white supremacist regime in South Africa, independent black countries were unable to open diplomatic relations for fear of their own populations. How could they open relations with a state which denied their equality with white people? Now we see the UAE opening diplomatic relations with a state which is openly, according to Israeli groups, according to many other groups, it's a Jewish supremacist regime which indulges in periodic massacres of Arabs, Muslims and Christians, because they're the wrong kind of people. So clearly the UAE and the Israelis are shaking hands over a huge mound of corpses. The last time round was several thousand Palestinians massacred. The problem for the UAE is that this will continue. The Israelis talk about mowing the lawn, that is, periodic massacres of people in Gaza. How will this new friendship survive in the eyes of the people of the UAE the next time several thousand Arabs, Palestinian Arabs, are lined up for slaughter by the Israeli regime? Look, the problem is that this will go on, and people will be able to see on their TV sets that this is the most disgraceful alliance of a regime which obviously lacks any sense of dignity, and it's allying itself with Israel, which, as I said, is designed to carry out the ethnic cleansing of Palestinian Arabs. And I would suggest one reminder to all those who are welcoming this: there are no limits to Israeli appetites for land. The Palestinians are fighting to defend the whole Middle East against the Zionist project. Remember that the Zionists believe that anywhere the Israeli army is able to be stable, that is the land of Israel. Other countries have a notion of their country having borders that are delineated, but Israel seized and incorporated a piece of Syria, and there are no limits to its appetites towards other Arab countries other than what's diplomatic at that particular time. So the alliance between the UAE and Israel goes back quite a long way. In fact, the American press was openly reporting back in 2018, I think, that the UAE had contracted an Israeli-American group of mercenaries called Spear Operations to carry out an assassination program in Yemen of opponents of the invasion there, the occupation. So there are appetites for economic cooperation, agriculture, tourism, and so on, but it's fundamentally driven by strategic needs. And the USA, the head office for both Tel Aviv and Abu Dhabi, demands that they cooperate together. And the Saudis won't be far behind, because El Al flights, which are carrying Israelis to the Emirates and elsewhere, overfly Saudi territory. So there's already a cozy relationship. Now, I'd remind your viewers that when Mohammed bin Salman went to speak to a Zionist meeting in New York 2 years ago, widely reported in the pro-Israel press in the USA, he harshly condemned the Palestinians in a way that made even the Israeli Zionists actually shocked them with his hostility to the Palestinians. So there's no doubt that this is cementing in public a strategic relationship which has been developing and real for a very long time. But as I say, I don't remember African states opening diplomatic relations with the white supremacist regime. How shameful can it be for Arab regimes to open relations with a regime which is openly saying that the Arabs are inferior?
All right, thanks a lot. Mick Napier from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign speaking to us from Edinburgh. Also, thanks to Mona Candela, our correspondent, joining us from Ramallah. New UN report says at least 1,146 migrants lost their lives while trying to reach Europe by sea in the first half of the year. The International Organization for Migration says the figure is two times more than the first half of 2020. Also, the number of refugees and migrants traveling on sea routes to Europe has increased by 56%. The IOM says the real number of migrant deaths is much higher, as many shipwrecks go unreported and others are hard to verify. Human rights organizations have warned that the lack of proactive search and rescue operations in international waters is a contributing factor to the increase. France has announced that its military presence in the Sahel region will end in the first quarter of 2022. President Emmanuel Macron said there will be a gradual reduction of military forces and the end of the Barkhane operation. However, he noted that France is not withdrawing entirely from the region. The Barkhane operation dates back to an initial deployment in January 2013 as Paris intervened to allegedly fight terrorism in Mali. France currently has more than 5,000 troops in the Sahel region, which stretches across Africa south of the Sahara Desert and spans half a dozen countries. During the past years, France has maintained military intervention in the volatile area under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but has failed in its reported mission. The United Nations is set to establish a panel of experts to investigate systemic racism in policing amid widespread discrimination against people of African descent, especially in the U.S. The panel of three experts in law enforcement and human rights will have a three-year mandate to probe the root causes and effects of racism. It will look at issues ranging from excessive use of force, racial profiling, and police handling of peaceful protests. The panel will investigate law enforcement across the world, but the United States will be the focus of its work, with the murder case of George Floyd in 2020 as its reference. For years, the U.S. has been the scene of police killings of African Americans. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
June 28, 2021, on the occasion of the National Judiciary Week and the martyrdom anniversary of Ayatollah Martyr Beheshti and other personalities. The Judiciary Transformation Plan is a solid and practical plan. The movement has begun. Well, a plan was prepared in the judiciary, Later, this plan was revised, and we saw the second upgraded version of that plan presented by Mr. Raisi. The plan is good and well prepared. Some plans are prepared here and there for the sake of formality, and they only state some bland generalities. But there is no generality in this plan. This plan is a good, strong plan. It is specifically long-term, and it has a timetable for various projects. It has determined the basis and direction of the movement, which indicates that this plan is, in the true sense of the word, operational, and not a plan with extravagant and impractical goals. This is a good plan, and you should use it as the standard for your work. Of course, it may be necessary to update this plan over time, but this does not mean that the trajectory should be subject to constant change. The path must be a clear and direct path. Another point is that everyone should be informed of this plan. I have received reports that some influential people in the judiciary do not know about it correctly. The plan should be made public so that experts in the judiciary branch can see it. Firstly, everyone should define and understand their duties on the basis of the plan. And secondly, if they have an opinion, they should reflect it to higher authorities, so no one should remain uninformed. The necessity to fill the legal gaps. Another thing about the plan is that I heard there are some legal vacuums, that is, laws are needed to fully implement this document. You have to pursue these laws, and you should not wait for the Majlis to do so. You could prepare the required law and do not let the gap remain unfilled. In addition, the body of the judiciary branch should be encouraged to implement this plan. You can implement all kinds of encouragements and incentives. This was one point about the transformation plan in the judiciary branch and its complete execution and follow-up process.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
The Mujahideen Khalq group sided with the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein when the Ba'athist regime attacked Iran in 1980. The group claims to have fought for the Iranian people, yet it has the blood of thousands of Iranian civilians on its hands. This year, the annual three-day meeting of the MKO terrorist group is hosted by Albania. The group gathers hired supporters among several former and current American and European officials to deliver paid speeches. This year, several high-profile Western politicians, including Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša, a number of U.S. lawmakers, as well as former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, are among invitees. Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša also delivered a speech at the conference. That drew harsh criticism from Iran and promoted the Iranian Foreign Ministry to summon the Slovenian ambassador to Tehran. In a statement on Sunday, the ministry slammed the Slovenian Prime Minister's move as unacceptable and undiplomatic. Angered by the participation of Iranians in the June presidential election, Pompeo claimed that the vote was a boycott.
The program of sanctions and pressure employed by the Trump administration needs to remain the model for engagement with Iran if we want to ensure the security of the American people and better lives for the Iranian people. In Washington, D.C., there is much consensus, as evidenced by the overwhelming support for the sanctions regime that we put into place.
In response, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said the MKO is a terrorist cult having the blood of Iranian people on its hands. Saeed Khatibzadeh denounced Western politicians, including Pompeo, for selling themselves cheap to the Europe-hosted circus. He also accused the West of shameful hypocrisy driven by an insatiable thirst for money and anti-Iran obsession.
Well, I think it's fairly obvious that the MKO is being supported by the Western countries because it is essentially carrying out imperialist interests. Obviously, the MKO is right there in design in order to overthrow the Iranian government and place some kind of cult activity inside the country. I mean, it's very clear that they're being used as a proxy force to fight the Iranian government.
Iran has always complained that the West's support for a terrorist group such as MKO violates the UN Charter and international norms. The Mujahideen Khalq organization has conducted numerous assassinations and bombings against Iranian statesmen and civilians since the 1979 victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution. Out of the nearly 17,000 Iranians killed in different terrorist attacks over the past four decades, about 12,000 of them have fallen victim to the MKO. MKO's rift with Iran worsened when its leader, Masoud Rajavi, aligned with former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the eight-year Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s. MKO received funding, weapons, ammunition, vehicles, and the use of land in exchange for its support for Saddam. Despite all the crimes committed by the MKO, it is not currently listed by any Western country as a terrorist organization. The European Union and the US, that often claim to be anti-terrorism, rather removed the MKO from their lists of terror organizations in 2009 and 2012 respectively. Ever since, the West has changed its stance toward the MKO, propagating it not only as an opposition group, but misses no chance to fund the group and lobby in its favor by putting a blind eye to how the MKO spilled the blood of innocent people.
So this is a long-standing policy by the United States, and it shows that the U.S. is not interested in fighting terrorism whatsoever. They're very fond of being able to use terrorists to their own ends, to carry out their own means whenever it's in their interests to do so.
The West's support for the hated MKO group has added to a more feeling of distrust among Iranians toward the Western governments. West support for a terrorist cult only exposes their double standards when it comes to terrorist organizations. Haiti's President Jovenel Moïse was killed during an attack on his private residence in the capital of Port-au-Prince on early Wednesday. Haiti's First Lady was also wounded in the attack and evacuated to a hospital in Miami for treatment. She later accused enemies of sending mercenaries to kill the president and his family to thwart democratic changes in the country. That's why none of the Moïse's guards were injured in the attack. Moreover, Haitian officials have not yet provided a motif for the assassination or explained how the killers got past Moïse's security detail. Haitian police says they have identified 28 people in connection to the fatal shooting, of which two were U.S. citizens. The rest, all Colombian, remain at large. The Colombian Defense Ministry says initial findings suggest that several of the attackers have been retired members of the Colombian military. Colombian police have confirmed that four companies were involved in the assassination of the Haitian president. The companies recruited Colombian nationals who traveled to Haiti through the neighboring Dominican Republic. On the other hand, when Preston reports that two Haitian Americans were involved with the assassination, the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki declined to comment. This arouses suspicions about possible U.S. involvement. After all, the U.S. has a track record when it comes to these types of operations. In 2020, two U.S. citizens were arrested in Venezuela. The Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, accused Washington of plotting to invade his country, overthrow, and assassinate him. Maduro claimed that the invaders were trained and funded by the U.S. and Colombia. Also, there was the infamous Bay of Pigs operation. 50 years ago, a group of some 1,500 Cuban exiles, trained and financed by the CIA, launched an ill-fated invasion of Cuba from the sea in the Bay of Pigs. The plan was to overthrow Fidel Castro and his revolution. Furthermore, the U.S. track record in Haiti speaks volumes in how the U.S. has treated the country. A simple history check reveals the deep U.S. involvement in this tiny island nation. In 1914, the U.S. sent Marines into Haiti. It gained complete control over Haitian finances and the right to intervene in Haiti whenever the U.S. government deemed necessary at the time. The U.S. government also forced the election of a new pro-American president by the Haitian legislature in August 1915. The selection of a president that did not represent the choice of the Haitian populace increased unrest in Haiti. Meanwhile, Haiti has been struggling with a wave of extreme violence, a growing humanitarian crisis, and a worsening coronavirus pandemic, and now the assassination of Moïse has thrown the country into deeper turmoil, as his death leaves a power vacuum.
However, we do know for sure the United States that this solves a lot of problems for the United States regarding its interest in Haiti and their support for Jovenel Moïse and that administration. It was an untenable situation. They had already been supporting him through a very suspect, abolishing of the Constitution. He extended his term. Now he was ruling by decree, and they were about to force on the Haitian people another election and a new constitution under very, you know, circumstances in which the Haitian people didn't want. Clearly, the masses of Haitian people were in the street.
Haitian President Jovenel Moïse's death has led to confusion about who is the legitimate person to lead the country of 11 million people. Claude Joseph, who had resigned as prime minister, took charge of the government and named himself acting president in the hours after the assassination. Ariel Henry, whom Moïse had named prime minister but had not yet taken office, also claims he should be in charge. Furthermore, Joseph Lambert, who leads what remains of the Haitian Senate, joined two others seeking to rule the nation, announced that he was voted provisional president by his fellow senators Friday evening. With tensions high in the capital, crowds of people took to the streets Thursday night, burning cars and demanding justice. Meanwhile, the COVID-19 pandemic has been worsening in Haiti. According to the United Nations Children's Agency, Haiti was the only country in the Western Hemisphere to not have received a single dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. At the same time, according to the World Bank, the country is facing a dire economic situation. Its economy had shrunk further 3.8% in 2020, with about 60% of the population now living in poverty. Furthermore, according to UNICEF, more than 1.5 million children are currently in urgent need of humanitarian assistance in Haiti.
The United States is directly responsible for the situation, decidedly so. It's intentional to keep Haiti underdeveloped, to keep control of its resources and its labor and its markets under the control of foreign corporations.
With Haiti having a track record of interference from Western governments like the U.S. and France, it remains to be seen whether the country will be able to preserve any peace and stability as it goes through this transformation. Moïse's murder has prompted the government to call for U.S. and UN assistance. At this point, the U.S. has said it will only take necessary action to defend Americans and critical infrastructure.
violence is killing more people in the U.S. state of New York than the COVID-19 pandemic. That's according to New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. He announced on Thursday that he has declared gun violence in New York a disaster emergency, making extra funding and resources available to combat shootings statewide. The first of its kind executive order came at a time when New York City and the country as a whole are struggling to curtail the spike in gun violence. Speaking during an event at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, Cuomo said his plan includes short-term and long-term measures that treat gun violence as a public health crisis. Cuomo said nearly $139 million will be invested in prevention and employment programs to help youth and keep at-risk young people off the streets.
Fact, gun violence discriminates. The way COVID discriminated, gun violence discriminates. When you look among the victims of gun violence nationally, 59% non-white. New York State, 68% non-white. New York City, 77% non-white. Think about that, 77%.
Well, these poor Black and Latino neighborhoods and people are likely to be victims because crime is rampant in these communities. But why is crime rampant in these communities? Well, as we see and we know, poverty exacerbates not only just gun violence, but all sorts of violence, petty theft, nonviolent crimes, drugs, gang violence. And these poor Black and Latino neighborhoods have been neglected by the government, by New York State, as well as their neighborhoods have been sold out. Gentrification throughout New York City is specifically targeting neighborhoods in Brooklyn, Queens, and the Bronx.
Cuomo also announced he was going to sign legislation that allows for civil lawsuits against gun manufacturers, distributors, and dealers for how they market and sell firearms. The governor added that over the 4th of July weekend, at least 51 people fell victim to gun violence across the U.S. state alone. U.S. President Joe Biden announced last month his plan to fight the rising gun crimes across the country.
Today, the department is announcing, as I just did, a major crackdown on stem the flow of guns used to commit violent crimes. It's zero tolerance for gun dealers who willfully violate key existing laws and regulations. Let me repeat, zero tolerance.
His plan includes allocating more funds to law enforcement agencies to improve their ability to track and disrupt gun trafficking. He's set to meet with the country's law enforcement, local elected officials, and advocates to discuss the plan on Monday. The White House says the $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief package provides funding not only to the police, but also to programs such as youth employment, which can help reduce crime rates. The Democrats and Republicans are now pointing fingers at each other over soaring gun violence, with the GOPs criticizing Biden's performance in fighting crimes and Democrats blaming their political rivals for blocking their proposals on gun control.
The American obsession with guns at its root is because our founding fathers and the right have just made it part of the American identity, make it seem as if to be American is to own a gun, when being American is so much more than that. It's about working hard and defending your neighbor and, you know, wanting better for yourself.
An FBI report in March pointed to a 25% increase in the number of homicide cases in 2020 compared to a year before. Figures suggest the rising trend has continued into 2021, fueling concerns that the U.S. could witness one of its highest numbers of homicides it has ever recorded this year.
Lebanon is just days away from a social explosion. The stark warning has been made by Lebanon's caretaker Prime Minister Hassan Diab, who has called on the international community to help the country avoid an all-out economic and social crisis. According to the World Bank, Lebanon is now experiencing one of the worst economic depressions in modern history. Diab has been serving in a caretaker capacity since resigning in the wake of the catastrophic August 4 Beirut port explosion. More than 200 people were killed and over 6,000 others injured in the giant blast. Dozens of people are still unaccounted for. Since then, politicians have been unable to agree on a new government. I appeal through you to the kings, princes, presidents and leaders of brotherly and friendly countries. And I call upon the United Nations and all international bodies, the international community, and the global public opinion to help save the Lebanese from death and prevent the demise of Lebanon. DF has urged friendly nations to help Lebanon despite the lack of a new government. He said only a new cabinet could restart talks with the International Monetary Fund so that the country may get out of its deepening crisis.
Linking aid to Lebanon with government formation has started to threaten the lives of people and to the Lebanese entity because the pressures that are being exercised and the siege imposed on Lebanon do not affect the corrupt. Instead, it is the Lebanese people who pay the heavy price that threatens their lives and their future.
Amid the political standoff, occasional unrest marked by attacks on government buildings, and the torching of banks and financial institutions by certain elements has sparked warnings of what's to come. Lebanon is now on the brink of total collapse. Anger over fuel shortages has spilled into fights at petrol stations since the country is short of fuel. The national currency has now lost more than 90% of its value since October 2019. The country's gross domestic product dropped from close to $55 billion in 2018 to an estimated $33 billion last year. GDP per capita also plummeted by around 40%. The nation's unemployment rate spiked from 28% in February 2020 to nearly 40% by the end of the year.
It's because the whole economic crisis is manufactured. The central bank manager is controlled by the United States, and all the banks have also loyalty to the United States. And so over the last 2.5 years, these banks moved out close to $60 billion out of the country, which crashed the lira. And now all that money is in Switzerland. Nobody's being held responsible.
The crisis has worsened, with the central bank cutting back on financing imports with subsidized dollars. The crisis is mostly linked to the sanctions that the U.S. and its allies have imposed on Lebanon, as well as foreign intervention in the Arab nation's domestic affairs.
While the United States has been trying for more than 15 years, and even more than that, to corner Hezbollah in Lebanon and get the population to rise up against it. It didn't work in 2006 in the war directly with apartheid Israel.
Over 250 of Washington's sanctions targets are in Lebanon or related to the country, and this number has been growing quickly. U.S. sanctions have seriously undermined the stability of the banking sector by reducing the inflow of foreign capital.
So the purposeful crashing of the economy and making life harder for Lebanese people, the United States is hoping that the population in Lebanon would rise up against Hezbollah. And as we've heard from Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah will try its best to make sure that this plan doesn't work.
Saudi Arabia has also imposed its own sanctions, including banning its citizens from traveling to Lebanon, where Riyadh-backed elements have been jockeying for position.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Deen al-Islam, deeni, wal-ardu ghayru deeni, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about the laws of divorce according to Ayatollah Sistani's fatwas. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazvini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in Fiqh and Usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Let's talk about divorce, a civil divorce. Is a civil divorce, according to the laws of Western countries, valid in the eyes of Islam? Let's assume one of them has taken place, all right,
yes,
in one of the Western countries, and the husband, is certain or adamant not to grant his wife the Sharia divorce, and does not or is not willing to provide maintenance for her, and does not also accept mediation. What should the woman do? Noting that her patience will certainly wear thin and eventually put her in an untenable situation.
Well, I would like to say that there are many such cases occurring here and there in the world, with both the husband and the wife having problem, domestic problem, and they cannot reconcile with each other, and they cannot put up with each other also. Therefore, life is difficult for the husband and the wife, since they do not reach any kind of understanding, or they cannot actually come to a solution with regard to the dispute they have. And as a result, the wife in the family encounters a very difficult situation, as you rightly mentioned, untenable situation, which becomes often on unbearable for the wife. And in that case, since she does not have access to a mujtahid, or she cannot, since she cannot convince her husband to divorce her according to Islamic Sharia, therefore she turns to a civil court to get herself rid of that husband. Or, for example, the court, the Islamic court, actually pronounces the divorce or declares the wife as separated in the eye of the country's law. Now, the question, as you mentioned, is whether this kind of divorce is valid or not. Obviously, the divorce is not valid because there are certain conditions which must be fulfilled, and those conditions are important conditions, which, if not fulfilled, the divorce will not be considered or deemed valid. Now, we will, inshallah, discuss those conditions later on, but when it comes to a woman's actually problem with her husband, of course, she can turn to a mujtahid and discuss her situation with a mujtahid or his representative, because a mujtahid may or may not have representatives in her country, in her respective country. And if a mujtahid does have a wakil or a representative,
or a proxy.
Yeah, a proxy. And in that case, that woman should consult the mujtahid's representative, because she cannot talk to the mujtahid directly. And of course, it's in modern time, it's very difficult to travel all the way to the mujtahid's office or to the mujtahid's house to discuss her problem directly with that mujtahid.
But they thanks to cyberspace,
yes,
that is possible today, very easily.
Thanks to the cyberspace or to the internet or IT, information technology and whatever, it is now possible, however, to contact your mujtahid indirectly, though. And therefore, if the mujtahid comes to know that the husband, that the wife is in a difficult condition, in an unbearable situation, which is technically called haraj, okay? Haraj is that unbearable situation, which is a situation which is generally unbearable, okay? For some people, it may be bearable, it may be tolerable, but for some others, it is not tolerable. Therefore, it is
so
termed,
it differs from person to person?
Yeah, from person to person. But we are talking about women in general, okay? When there is a problem, when there is a difficulty which is generally not bearable, in that case, okay, the mujtahid can advise the husband to either mend his behavior, to correct his himself, or he should actually provide his wife with maintenance, because according to your question, that the husband is not providing his wife with food, clothing, and medical expenses, and he is not supporting his wife financially. So the mujtahid will advise him to support his wife financially, to provide him, provide his wife, provide for his wife in terms of food, clothing, and whatever she needs in terms of daily expenses.
I see.
And if that husband is not willing to do any of these two courses of action, then, of course, the mujtahid will have the right and the authority, of course, to go ahead and divorce
her from him.
Yeah, to divorce, carry out the divorce, and, of course, pronounce that the divorce and set her free from the marriage contract.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Sheikh Javed, apart from the conditions that you talked about that come with the territory of the divorce and
sure.
they need to be met,
yes.
right, for a civil divorce and also an Islamic divorce to happen, if the husband were willing to provide
mm-hmm.
the maintenance and the stuff like that,
sure.
and none of these conditions were like the one, just like the question that I asked, would a civil divorce be valid then? I mean, according to the Western laws, because normally as my talking to you, like in the previous programs, you reiterated the fact that most of Ayatollahs and religious authorities accept the laws of the, for example, the residing country where you need to live and abide by and conform to the laws of those countries where you live, right?
Yes.
Like, for example, the traffic regulations.
Sure,
you
sure.
you can't go against those rules,
yes.
all right?
Mm-hmm.
As long as you live in those countries, you reside in those countries, you need to abide by those rules as a good citizen, right?
Yeah.
So would, in that case, a civil divorce be valid?
Well, a civil divorce is not valid, even though the religious authorities have generally advised mm-hmm. their followers, okay, to abide by the country of which they are a national, for
mm-hmm.
example. So, we should differentiate between traffic laws or regulations and also giving tax, okay?
Mm-hmm.
As a Muslim, you are living, for example, in a non-Muslim country, you should pay your tax, okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you should be a law-abiding citizen.
Yes.
But when it comes to haram and halal, you should not go against them because they are obligatory duties. For example,
uh-huh.
wine is drinking wine is haram. All alcoholic beverages are haram, and of course you cannot drink alcohol because it's permissible in the eye of that country's law.
Mm-hmm. So we can't call that a civil law.
Yeah,
then that is a ritual law that we have to differentiate.
Sure, we have to differentiate between a civil law and a ritual law. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And of course, a civil law is not a civil law. When it comes to when it violates an explicit Islamic teaching, in that case, a Muslim is not supposed to abide by it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we will further discuss
the
conditions
episodes, yes.
Of divorce in the upcoming session.
Episode. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javed. That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB.